Hello, everybody, and welcome again. We are actually beginning number 37 in a treatise on white magic video commentaries. But right here, just to reread this fifth rule so we have it in mind what we're dealing with. Three things engage the solar angel before the sheath created passes downward. The condition of the waters, the safety of the one who thus creates, and steady contemplation. Thus are the heart, the throat, and eye allied for triple service. So then going over here to where we were on page 163, we've talked about the safety of the one who thus creates a little bit. And the dangers, it says here, there are forms of thought unencumbered by much desire matter, which failing to pass downward poison the man on mental levels. So we have here the first of the dangers is the idée fixe, which is like an entity, really, and terrorizes its creator. And then we have the multiplying, the possible multiplying of thought forms so fast that the light of the soul fails to penetrate, and it's kind of like a suffocation process, spiritually considered, and with health effects, the man is smothered, is suffocated by his own thought forms, and succumbs to the miasma which he himself has engendered. This takes us then to video commentary number 37, or again, there are lines of thought which draw forth from the emotional body a reaction of a poisonous nature. So this is like, let's call this like number three. Let's see. This is right. One, two, three. Here we go. Number three. Or, again, there are lines of thought which draw forth from the emotional body a reaction of a poisonous nature. DK has talked about these sort of psychopathologies which make the first and fifth ray man untouchable. The brooding second and fourth ray, second, fourth, and sixth ray man, dangerous once he reveals that upon which he has been brooding, unless it's of a positive nature. And then also the third and sixth ray type tend to impose their thought on others and become, you know, extremely tiresome and overbearing. So a certain line of thought is followed by a human being in relation to his brethren. It breeds hatred, jealousy, and envy, and works through into manifestation in such a manner that it produces those physical plane activities which cause the death of their creator. So it's not only what we do, it's what we think. And thinking is a form, we might say, of doing. So just getting rid of some extra clutter here. You know, there are things that just slow us down. This may be literal, as in the case of murder, which is in many cases the result of crystallized intent, or it may result in disease. All right, so, and of course, obviously, it's possible to work out in such a way that others are harmed as well as oneself. So the the safety of the one who thus creates, yes, this is a question of his safety, but also the safety of others. Pure thought, right motive, and loving desire are the true correctives of disease. And where the desire for these, which does animate many, is raised to constructive thinking, there will be the gradual elimination of disease. Now, this is very appropriate to think about. Let's repeat it. Pure thought, right motive, and loving desire are the true correctives of disease, and where the desire for these, which does, in fact, animate many, is raised to constructive thinking, there will be the gradual elimination of disease. And this, let's see if I can get this to work properly. Well, there was just a little freezing of the screen there for a moment. But in any case, this will also lead to initiation. You know, let's see if I can. It's hard to say exactly what has been carried over from before, but we'll start it here. The initiate of the third degree is unlikely to fall victim to the usual illnesses. There may be illnesses, but not the usual. And let's just say that this is even more true of the initiate of the fourth degree, unless for special purposes such an initiate is taking upon himself the disease, the strain of others. And this happens, I'm remembering a story about Ramana Maharshi. Now, maybe, you know, from the point of view of the southern Indian school, he could have been considered a master. And I'm recalling that his disciples offered to take his cancer away. I think he had cancer of the throat, something like that. I know that Ramakrishna did. But it was some form of cancer, and Ramana Maharshi said to them, "Well, where do you think I got it?" Meaning, of course, that he had taken it on from them. So let it never be forgotten that the great ones do not look for those who only desire and aspire. Huh, this is so important. they look for those who blend with their desire the determination to learn to use the mental bodies and become their mental bodies and become creators, and who will work constructively towards these ends. So the masters look for practical, creative people, and not simply for those who desire and aspire. There is a veil associated with the etheric body, and it is called the veil of aspiration, and it blocks true action, because we rest back and we are, you know, satisfied with aspiration alone. You know, the veil of impulsion, the veil of distortion, the veil of separation, and finally the veil of aspiration. All of those veils have to be destroyed so that the plan of the soul can come through the various vehicles and the etheric body in the right manner, without being disrupted or sidetracked. So we have here problems when the mental creation does not descend in the proper manner, clothing itself with the correct desire energy and the correct vital energy, and finally make its appearance upon the physical plane, you know, either by normal means of the active external man, or in the case of the system and thought promoted by this book, by magical means, a special inner magical process which causes thought forms to actually appear without the, as it were, hands and feet of the objective man. And thus it will be seen why, in all systems of true occult training, the emphasis is laid on right thinking, loving desire, and clean, pure living. And this clean, pure living, you know, this is associated with the etheric body and the dense physical body. So the mind, the astral body, and the etheric physical nature. The emphasis is laid on, it's the foundation, really, right thinking, loving desire, right thinking in line with the plan, and that portion of the plan which it is the will of our supervising soul that we, the soul and incarnation, carry out. It's really our will. Loving desire, the desire which leads to harmony and unity, and pure, clean living, which does not corrupt in any way the form which must be taken. Only thus can the creative work be carried forward with safety. And only thus can the thought form pass downward into objectivity and be a constructive agent on the plane of human existence. And also, we find that there are many destructive agents. The methods used by the brother of the left-hand path and the methods of white magic have many similarities, but the motive is entirely different, and the alignment of the white brother, the white magician, goes much higher and not out along the line of Mahat and some sort of obscure Devic line, which DK hints at but does not fully describe. In any case, it strengthens materialism, that particular unwholesome method. But the white brother is aligned with the divine plan via the Antikorana, and, you know, with the purposes of himself as a triad monad and the purposes of the planetary logos in whom he, the white brother, plays his part. So now the third requirement is that there be steady contemplation. We've talked then about the safety of the one who thus creates and the condition of the waters. So I tell you what, maybe I make these little... We'll come back to the idea of the condition of the waters. And that will be, I think, in Rule 7 and Rule 8. And, you know, magic is a serious business, we've been led to understand, and a dangerous one for the unprepared, the unwary, the careless, you know. We don't want to be any of those things. We want to be well prepared and rightly motivated, equipped to do this work. So the study of steady contemplation comes next. You know, going back here, these are the factors: the condition of the waters, the safety of the one who thus creates, and steady contemplation. These are the factors which are being presented and discussed in Rule 5 here. Okay, now, steady contemplation. You will note here that the word meditation is not used, and the thought is a different one. The meditation process involving the use of thought and the mental building of the form so that it can be completed and rounded out and in line with the thought form of the disciples, group of co-disciples, and therefore with the plan. Now that's very interesting, because if it's in line with the disciples' group of disciples, it will be in line with the plan, assuming that group to be a wholesome one, has been completed to the best of man's ability. So the building process, let's just say, the building process has been completed as far as the thought form goes. Now he must with steadiness contemplate that which he has created, and with equal steadiness inspire it with the needed life so that it can fulfill its function. And this life may well relate to the vitality of the etheric body. So contemplation is another step. It's the step beyond meditation. Concentration, meditation, contemplation, illumination, inspiration, initiation. And then I take it a little further. Universalization, identification, from Leo to and through Pisces. So in meditation, we do a lot of thinking and reasoning, as we would expect in a Mercurian sign like Virgo, but Libra is different. He ceases to reason, to think, to formulate, and to build in mental matter. This part has been done, and it's good and necessary, and is only part of the process. The process continues. He simply pours his life into the form and sends it forth to carry out his will. Just as long as he can contemplate and hold steady, so will his creation fulfill its intention and act as his agent. So much steadiness, we might say poise, a Libran quality, is needed. And much uninterrupted gazing upon that, that which has been built. There's also a gradual overcoming of the distance between himself and the form created. In one way, he has to remain detached, and in another way, he remains somehow substantially identified with that form, just as we, when we contemplate others, we don't just think about them, we learn gradually to identify with them as them, because we know that we are everywhere. Harmlessness, so connected with Libra, you know, is the condition of the life of the man who realizes himself to be everywhere. So this is, so we are having a condition of focusing and energizing. And the I is very important in this process. So, well, several of the centers are involved, as we will see. Allied for triple service, the heart, the throat, the eye. Just so long as he can focus his attention on the ideal for which he created his thought form and can link the form and the ideal together in one steady vision. In other words, ideal has much to do with the direction in which the thought form must, as it were, travel. So, if the ideal is maintained, we will have the creation of an inspired thought form. So, excuse me, if he can link the form and the ideal together in one steady vision, just so long will it serve his purpose and express his ideal. Now, you know, the Creator, in a way, and for a time, has to keep his eye upon his creation because the eye is an integrative energy or force. And DK has just given us a big hint, and he seems to say, so herein lies the secret of all cooperation with the plan. We do not allow our thoughts to be separated from the idealism that created them. I remember how high idealism really is. It's found on the fifth subplane from below of the Buddhic plane. If I can just go there to remind us of this. Okay. There we go. Idealism, there it is. The third subplane from below and the fifth from, third subplane from above and the fifth from below, and it is the highest of the cities of the powers about which we are educated at this point. There are others and higher, and DK is withholding information about them because they are the objectives of the master of the wisdom. And the highest one is an objective even of a Chohan of the sixth degree. So, we have to deal with our thought form in a particular way. We have to keep our thought form inspired by the energy of high idealism associated with the divine plan. And, you know, I think we can do that. Maybe it's, there are some moments when we may lose, seem to lose our inspiration, but we have the method by which we can regain it. And those are meditative methods. We will now study for a while the words heart, throat, and eye, for they have a peculiar significance. These three form the apparatus to be employed by all disciples during the world cycle, which is so rapidly coming. We might say, in order to make sure that the disciple can perform his or her task. Heart, associated with buddhi, throat, associated with mentality, and the eye, you know, associated with various levels, it's the Ajna Center, and can be associated with the integrating personality, but also we can carry it farther and relate the Ajna Center to the entire spiritual triad. So synthesis of different kinds comes through the heart and the eye. I'm recalling in the old days, Alice Bailey created a couple of lesson sets in the Arcane School. And the first one was called, and it had a lot to do with Agni Yoga, the doctrine of the eye. And there's still some sort of possible separation and objectivity involved in that doctrine, but then follows the doctrine of the heart, which leads to the true synthesis, recognizing the identicality of life or being, which animates any object. So subject and object, finally, are experienced as one. And even through the right kind of contemplation through the eye, this can happen. there is not yet a very large body of disciples in incarnation at this time, excuse me, and that the apparatus with many who are functioning on the level of discipleship is but an embryo is profoundly true. So this is a realistic look at, you know, where we are. Maybe not sufficient number and not sufficiently equipped. An insufficient number of disciples who are insufficiently equipped for carrying out in fullness the indications here offered, or let's just say here discussed. It should be remembered, however, that the world cycle has only just been inaugurated and will cover a vast period of time. This world cycle has to do with Aquarius and may refer to the lesser equinoctial. I'd like to be able to spell that. Equinoctial age, or the greater age of approximately 25,000 years, also to be lived under the larger influence of Aquarius. So this equinoctial age, the earlier one, is about 2,000 years. Sometimes it's generalized as 2,500 years, 2,500, and sometimes more specifically, according to the kinds of numbers that are used when calculating yugas, 2,160 years. Those yuga numbers seem to have a lot to do with our solar system, at least, and we cannot say they are only planetary because finally, they demonstrate as the duration of our solar system, 311 trillion, 40 billion years. And that's a stupendous figure that Blavatsky says is real. And, you know, one day we will know for certain about the reality of that figure. Right now, it has to be maybe something of an hypothesis. Now, this is one of the interesting things that he says. Of course, the numbers have increased. So it should be remembered, however, that the world cycle has only just been inaugurated. You know, I think he's speaking in generalities here. We might say even the arrival of the highly Aquarian Francis Bacon was a in the early or let's just say in the late 16th century was a kind of harbinger of the Age of Aquarius, which is to begin fully in the year 2117. For that item, we are item of information. We are very grateful. You probably know the story that, you know, Keith Bailey and I were given some papers back in the old days by the last remaining disciple, and in it was a letter in which the Tibetan was speaking to Roberto Assagioli, and this letter was never published. And he does talk about the alignment of the vernal equinox with the 30th degree of Aquarius, as this process is retrogressive, going what we would consider to be backwards through the signs. And the way he expressed this information revealed to us that the year 2117 was the year when we could really begin to say that we had extracted ourselves from the Piscean sixth ray influence and had really and truly entered the age of Aquarius. And we might say, you know, Francis Bacon apparently died, we don't know, around the year 1616 or 1617, which is just 500 years before this official beginning of the age. And that's how, what we're told about is a, however you measure it, a 500-year overlap when dealing with the smaller equinoctial precessional ages. As well, interestingly, there is a Venus transit across the face of the Sun, such as we recently have experienced in 2004 and 2012, during that year, 2117. So the world cycle, and will cover a vast period of time. Now, because he said a vast period of time, this suggests that the world cycle is the Aquarian Platonic, we'll call it a great Platonic age of approximately 25,000 years, or, you know, if we take 20, let's see how we would do this. Okay. We will take 2160 and multiply by 12, and we'll get 25,944. So let's look at that again, clear it, and just take a look. Where is the clear? Somewhere? I'm sure I'm looking at it somehow. Well, maybe the, if I cannot, ah, there it is. Okay, so it's 2160, which is half of 432, very important number, times 12 equals 25920. That is the correct one. All right, or let's just say 25920 years. The Tibetan has his reasons for rounding off the duration of these cycles, and maybe some time we will know why. I suspect it's because of the overlapping periods, which in the case of these, the very large cycle, involves an overlapping period of some 5,000 years between great Platonic years of what he generalizes as 25,000 years. So from 500 for the lesser equinoctial ages or precessional ages to 5,000. And who knows whether we get into a continuation of those overlaps in much, much larger figures. But I think he would be justified in saying, will cover a vast period of time if we, in fact, we are dealing with a period of some 25,000 or almost, in one case, 26,000 years. This was interesting to me when I read it because I figured, you know, it's written, you know, in the early 30s or late 20s, and it shows the small number of real disciples. I assume he means, you know, he's meaning accepted disciples, ruled, as one of my colleagues put it, largely by Mercury and Saturn. You know, by the time you reach accepted discipleship, Mercury and Saturn are very important. There are only about 400 accepted disciples in the world at this time. That is, men and women who really know they are disciples and know what their work is and are doing it. So, that's almost 100 years ago that this was written, or maybe 90 years ago, maybe a little less. And I'm sure the number has grown greatly because there's been a huge wave of consciousness which has swept over humanity, a huge wave of leading to the elevation of consciousness in so many people, and plus the Tibetans' books more widely read by people than we can imagine, he tells us, will have alerted quite a number of people to who they really are. So it's not just about the work that is being done. I mean, I guess one can be an unconscious and very useful disciple, unconscious that one is a disciple, and yet having relinquished perhaps one's inner knowledge of these things, and still not, according to this definition, be what's called a self-knowing accepted disciple. There are only about 400 accepted disciples in the world at this time. That is, men and women who really know they are disciples and know what their work is and are doing it. And so, from this perspective, they have to have occult knowledge. There are nevertheless many hundreds out of the present generation of young people who stand on the verge of acceptance, and thousands are on the probationary path. Now, these numbers are not great, but the incarnational process is wisely controlled by the masters, so that sufficient numbers of disciples will have taken incarnation when certain acts or factors or certain actions for which they would be responsible must take place. This is all about the divine plan and what kind of army of Maitreya or how many in the army of Maitreya are needed to fulfill the requirements of any particular years or decades or quarter centuries, etc. All of this, I suppose, is controlled by the three great lords, to a degree. Nevertheless, of those many who stand on the verge of acceptance, perhaps some of us are those. We have to make sure that we do what is required so that true acceptance comes. That is our duty and our requirement. It's so easy to talk about these things, somewhat in general, and not realize that the ball is in our court and that we must be the ones who take the necessary steps to, as it is said, make the grade. It is our responsibility, RSPB, to take those steps which will allow us to make the grade. Okay, so I think that number is interesting. I wonder what it would be now. Would it be probably in the thousands? And how many thousands, Because if that wave of consciousness, which was not really available in the late 20s, really swept over humanity, and the number of accepted disciples remained what it was, as given in this book, then the wave would not have performed its task. In all truly esoteric groups, there should be forming a group in which an intellectual understanding of this mechanism of heart and throat and eye will be found. You know, this is what we call technical occultism, sometimes associated with the fifth ray, but necessary to all eventually. We all get time to spend on all of the rays from the personality perspective, and add to that the rays of the mind or the emotional and physical vehicles. And we do spend time on all the rays, and even the fifth ray, which some people who are more into abstract things kind of hold up their hand and say, well, that's not for me, but it is for us. It is the ray which guarantees the possibility of initiation. It should be constituted of those who are submitting themselves to a discipline and a training which will make its use a demonstrated fact in nature to them. So, you know, it's not just enough to talk about the heart and the throat and eye. We have to demonstrate the activity of, or so let's just say even the conscious activity of the heart, throat, and eye. And I would call attention to those words and request their careful study. So many of us are members of esoteric groups, and if we're careful in our study, we will arrive at an intellectual understanding of the mechanism of heart and throat and eye. And if we persist in our service, we will arrive at a practical understanding of how, by will, these different energy centers can be put into a still more productive use than they already are in our case. So these esoteric groups, this group, so let's say it, meaning the inner group, should be constituted of those who are submitting themselves to a discipline and a training which will make its use, the group's use, a demonstrated fact in nature to them, or the mechanism. We can say it's the mechanism's a use, a demonstrated fact. So, and another thing to notice here, that every truly esoteric group has a still more esoteric inner core. And DK demonstrated this. You know, he'd get nine people together, but of those nine, three were central to the process. And this is, if I could only find that diagram that shows the triangle in the middle, and at each apex another triangle coming off the point. You know, so basically, it's as if there were four triangles. And the inner triangle members participated in each one of them in more than one triangle. I'll see if I can find that. It's somewhere here, but I always hesitate to go on one of those great searches, as Tui and I do have a webinar coming up here in just a very short time. A mechanism, so I would call your attention to this, a demonstrated fact, you know, and this is all about practical occultism. A mechanism in the natural body comes into use in two ways. By natural body, do we mean the dense physical body? Let's just see, because to a certain extent, any body on the lower 18 subplanes is of nature, we might say. A mechanism in the natural body comes into use in two ways. First, its use is involuntary, and there is no comprehension of how or why or when the apparatus is used. In other words, we hear, we see, you know, we feel, etc. And this we do naturally. So we can say here, we use the senses naturally and without attention to what they are or how they can be further cultivated. An animal employs a mechanism analogous in many respects to that employed by human. He sees and hears and functions organically along similar lines to the human, but lacks the mental understanding and the linking of cause and effect, which are characteristic of the higher kingdoms of nature, at least the conscious linking. I think that in animal learning, in animal, there is an unconscious linking of cause and effect. At least it appears that way, though there is no vivid consciousness of this happening and no awareness, objective awareness of this linking. It just has a practical result. Now, so here is a further description. A similar state of affairs exists in the early stages of the path of discipleship and the final stages of the probationary path. He's telling us something interesting. The path of discipleship begins earlier than the path of probation. Interesting. And the final stages of the probationary path. The disciple becomes aware of capacities and powers which are not as yet intelligently under his control. They are present, but not controlled, or to be used at will. He experiences flashes of insight and of knowledge which seem unaccountable and of no immediate use. He contacts vibrations and the phenomena of other realms, but remains unaware of the process whereby he has done so. So, you know, so far, because of lack of occult training, there is no scientific approach to the utilization, to the, utilization of these abilities, and is incompetent either to renew or recall the experience. So within his etheric body, he senses active forces. Sometimes he can localize them, and in any case, he admits theoretically that there is awakening into conscious activity, a sevenfold structure, which is symbolic in form and potent when employed. This is the awakening process. We all go through this, you know, and there is always a fresh frontier. We have a number of mechanisms within us, and we have to learn really how to use these mechanisms to recognize. That an occult mechanism is beginning to come to life, it's not the same as utilizing it. It consciously. He cannot as yet control it, and he is quite incapable of calling it into intelligent cooperation with his purposes and ideas, no matter how hard he tries. This is the, you know, the beginning stage. Something's there. It's interesting. It's unpredictable. I don't know how it happened, what triggered it, and I cannot at will and with knowledge call it into activity for my concentrated purposes. All that he can do is to register such phenomena and keep a record of these experiences, bearing always in mind that in the early stages of his unfoldment, only the coarsest and most material of the vibrations will be registered upon the brain consciousness. So this is this discussion is all about growing in receptivity as discipleship progresses. Ever more, or let's just say the receptivity of ever more subtle vibrations. Okay. So this is where we are. He, that's we. He simply has to wait and to bring his mind to bear upon the purifying of his vehicles and the elimination of all that he recognizes is liable to distort his vision. Okay, I see that, well, I did think that I never had the plural. And it's even a popular word, vibes. Okay. He simply has to wait and to bring his mind to bear upon the purifying of his vehicles and the elimination of all that he recognizes as liable to distort his vision and the theoretical approach to growth is useful at this stage. The teaching advises what to do. This period may be long or short according as the aspirant is entering into the subjective consciousness for the first time or is taking up the thread of an older and partially achieved undertaking, and this would be recapitulatory. And I think, you know, we recognize when we can do certain things and recapitulatory. All right, well, there's capitulatory, so there must be a recapitulatory. All right. I've been writing a lot of operas in my life, and someone said, oh, well, you really must have been involved in that kind of work before. A number of people have told me because, you know, it came fairly quickly in the whole design of it, and I believe they're correct, and I'm sure we all have those kinds of activities which are supported by some degree of a previous exposure to them, some degree of success with them. I would like here to make perfectly clear to all true and earnest aspirants that in the training to be given during the next few decades, the unfoldment of astral vision and hearing will be ruled out. The next few decades. What does he mean by few? Let's see. What are a few? Some people are very happy about these astral visions and astral hearing, but they can be inhibitory of the higher types of developments which the masters really want to see take place in our consciousness. Or, if it exists, will eventually have to be overcome. Now that, you know, he's talking about these visions, these visions and these auditory phenomena, phenomena, that should be the plural. Let's see if I've got it. phenomena. Well, I'm going to also phenomena. I'll do it that way too. So these phenomena are dealt with as if they are obstacles, are treated as if they are obstacles. Now, the usual psychic doesn't think that's the case. Anything inherited from the Atlantean past is considered to be useful and could be if the higher psychism takes over with it. But oftentimes there is a simultaneous involvement in higher and lower at a certain point. That's reasonable, but sometimes there's simply an engagement in the lower and it does obscure the development of the higher. The true disciple has endeavored to center himself on the mental plane with the object in view of transferring his consciousness still higher into the wider, inclusive awareness of the soul. But what really is soul awareness? And do we recognize it when it occurs? So we're trying to get into the higher nature of the psyche and away from those animal related abilities which long ago in Atlantis were the object of our attention. Still, they are new to us when they recur after so many years, and so we treat them as something quite wonderful and marvelous when in fact it is a recapitulation. Their appearance is a recapitulation of something that happened long ago. His aim is to include the higher, and there is no need for him at this stage to regain that astral facility which was his possession, as you well know, was the possession, as you well know, of the little evolved races of the earth and of many of the higher animals. So this statement puts various abilities in proportion. Master Moria says, well, you know, if you want to get people's attention, compare what they do to what animals do, and then the pride of human pedigree will take over and people will be more cautious. There are, you know, some early psychic races still on our planet, and as far as contact with soul goes, it's not part of their recognition or their approach. Although in the very, very early days, maybe early Lemurian days, we're told that the human being looked with great devotion upon the inner solar angel, which was definitely sensed at the time. And later that kind of sensitivity was lost. Later on, when adeptship has been reached, and let's make that a, he can function on the astral plane should he so choose. But it should be remembered that the masters work with the soul aspect of humanity and all forms, and the master works and does not work with their astral bodies per se. Okay. This is often forgotten by teachers both in the East and in the West. And so, you know, obviously, must now be remembered. Okay, wait a second. Must now be remembered, even if some humbling is part of the memory of this fact. Okay, well, we have our webinar coming up, everybody, and I just want to say that this will be the end of a Treatise on White Magic video commentary, number 37, I believe, I hope so, number 37, and we started out on page 163, I believe, and we are now at 166. But the only way I can really tell, and it's a great failing of mine, unfortunately, is to go back to the beginning. So this is the beginning of a Treatise on White Magic video commentary number 38, and we are on at least on page 166. And let's see where we... I think we're where we really began. Yeah, well, we were on 163. So to 166. I know I'm filling these things in as we go, but in blue, better than red, I think sometimes. Less shocking, more smooth. All right. Let's say that that's the end of our program here, and we will continue when it is possible. I would say that we are roughly one-third of the way through the book, but of course a lot of discretionary time is needed to keep up this kind of work, and things can get quite busy. Thank you for participating, thinking, and you know, once the first listening is over, then comes the opportunity to really go through the video, stop it where you want to think more, and go on, stop it again where you want to think more. It can take a while, and this can be done in study groups or on your own. So all the best to you, and we'll talk to you soon as we move forward. Bye-bye.